RN's White Paper, a free monthly digital magazine. Subscribe at our homepage.
And hello, Natasha Mitchell, joining you on RN for the next hour. How's your morning going? Did you pick up a coffee on the way to work? Is a pot brewing beside you right now? That beautiful wafting aroma filling your nostrils with vitality. Are you particular about your coffee beans? Or is it a case of whatever's on special in the shop shelf at the time? Our everyday economist, Peter Martin, is looking at the economics of fair trade products like coffee today. Is everything quite as it seems? And also on the program this morning, sometimes relatives pass on something precious. It's an object that perhaps previous generations weren't quite ready to digest the contents of, though. Diaries can be like that, particularly war diaries. What have you found out about your family in diaries passed on to you? A great story from World War One coming up. First up today, a global education leader and one especially committed to education reform, to mathematics in the classroom, and to struggling learners. Dr. David Shard was appointed by US President Barack Obama to his National Board of Education Sciences. David is currently the elected chair of that. He's also dean of the Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Shard has been a keynote speaker at this week's annual Successful Learning Conference. It's hosted by the University of Sydney. Welcome to Life Matters, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me, what does America's National Board of Education Sciences do, this board that you've been appointed to?
Yeah, well, in the past 10 years or so, there's been a significant change in the way we think about investing in educational research. And the idea is to really change the culture toward evidence-based practices, knowing what works and with whom it works and under what conditions it works. And so our job is to advise the president and the secretary of education on how best to use taxpayer dollars to invest in those areas of research and innovation that we feel need to be improved.
Now, what's really driven that shift in America in the last 10 years? What's at the heart of it, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a number of issues. One, you know, we're probably behind the healthcare area by about 100 years when evidence-based practices became part of the way of thinking for doctors and healthcare providers. So the idea here is rather than focus on tradition and, you know, that my educational experience should be the same that my children receive, rather we want to say we have limited resources, we want to know what works, how well it works, and how do we solve educational problems. And so the effort really has been to shift toward a focus on data and evidence and outcomes rather than on continuing to do things that we really have no idea whether or not they're effective.
Yeah, how forceful is that sense of tradition as a driver for what happens in the classroom?
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be surprised, probably not surprised to know that it's very challenging to, like anything, it's challenging to get people to change their behavior when they think that what they're doing is working, even though evidence may suggest it isn't. I'll give you a perfect example. We assign homework in the United States for children to do practice and expand what they've done in the classroom, and we've learned that, in fact, homework probably has very little impact on student achievement.
Oh, the agony it causes so many parents.
I know.
But, and yet, we hang on to that.
We do.
Like a dog at a bone, don't we?
That's exactly right, yeah. So, you know, we're trying to understand, that's just a single example, but we're trying to understand everything from how to improve reading outcomes, how to improve getting more children interested in mathematics and science, which is an area that we're particularly concerned about, and how to both expand who gets access to that, but also expand or enhance sort of the level at which they work, because we need really well-qualified professionals in, you know, all kinds of areas that require science and mathematics and reasoning.
Well, so, speaking of maths and reasoning, this has been at the heart of your passion for education right from the go-get.
That's true.
Why? What ignited that early on in your career?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, I was good at math, which is often what we gravitate to, things that we feel strongly about. But then when I began to realize that I could actually work with children, because I like children, and I could use my math skills to be a teacher, that became very interesting to me. So I went to a university that had once been well known for only preparing teachers, and so they continued to have a strong model for teacher preparation. And then I went on into teaching. And you know, what I have found over the years is that if you can help children not be afraid of mathematics and see how it can be used to make sense of the world around them, that you can make a lot of progress and convince some children that mathematics or related fields, and there are many of them, should be ones that they pay attention to.
Fear of maths, I really want to come back to that, but
sure.
Let's just take a slight detour.
Yeah.
Because early on in your career too, you landed in the Peace Corps, in Lesotho in Africa. What was that experience like? I'm fascinated in what sort of awareness that brought you, and that you brought back into the American system.
Yeah, it was a great experience. I was there for 4 years. I taught high school for 3 of those years, and then I worked with primary schools. You know, many of the primary schools in places like Lesotho have one teacher and 100 and some children, often with limited resources. So my job was to move about the country and try to help some of those teachers improve what they were doing. But, you know, the one thing that it taught me that I think I'll forever hold on to was that talent and giftedness and sort of the ability to be academically outstanding is equally distributed across communities. What isn't equally distributed is opportunity. And so some of my brightest students were students that I worked with in sub-Saharan Africa who, you know, one example that comes to mind was a kind of a mature woman who had 2 children and wanted to go back and complete her high school degree. She was one of the brightest students I've ever worked with in the 28 years I've been in the field. And yet, when she finished her schooling, there were no opportunities for her to pursue higher education or to use those skills in a way that, I mean, there were not jobs, there were not, much like we would think if you get prepared well in high school, there will be something, an opportunity at the end of that. She didn't have that. So she was very bright. I think she probably could have done almost anything she wanted to in higher education, but couldn't. So that was an important insight for me.
Yes, indeed. And it's this passion that you have for, I guess, keeping people, opening up the scope of education for everybody, that really has driven the work that you do. And I'm interested that back in 2001, America enacted the No Child Left Behind Act, which I gather put in place standardized assessments to track students' progress, similar to what we call NAPLAN here, which tests numeracy, literacy at different stages of kids' schooling.
Yeah.
I'm interested, just in terms of your love of maths, has that helped or hindered children's learning of maths? Because in Australia there's been, David, a hell of a lot of debate about schools teaching to the test, especially around maths.
Yeah. I think I would give it a grade of about B-, Natasha. I think there are some aspects to it that are very positive. So prior to No Child Left Behind, the way we thought about testing the effectiveness of schools was really put on the shoulders of children. In other words, if school didn't work for a child, it was the child's problem. And so that one of the major changes that No Child Left Behind ushered in was that the problem really rested with the system. So the purpose of the standardized testing was to make sure the system was working for as broad a range of children as possible, rather than blaming children or their families for their failure to succeed in school. The downside of No Child Left Behind, of course, is that you do get people who game the system. So they, in some cases, we've found blatant examples of cheating. In other instances, we find a lot of teaching to the test. And, you know, one way of thinking about that is it's part of an evolution of cultural change in education, and that things will get better as we refine and improve. But I do think that it was a major move forward in some ways to take the pressure off of individual children who weren't succeeding in school and to really focus on how to improve the teaching, the quality of teaching and learning across the board.
But I do gather there's been some winding back with that awareness of standardised testing perhaps constraining the breadth of, the creativity of what a teacher can achieve in the classroom?
Yeah, there have been a number of things that have happened. The Obama administration has, one, given states waivers to not meet the 100% children proficient by 2014 deadline. But part of those waivers was to establish higher standards and also to improve the way we the methods by which we evaluate teachers, so not just looking at scores on a standardized test, but also observing them in the classroom. And so we're doing a lot of experimentation in that area right now in large city school districts and state level to determine what's the sort of constellation of things we should be looking at to ensure that children are getting all of the opportunities to be successful as they can. So there has been a considerable change in the last few years. We don't have a new law, unfortunately. Our Congress is still working on what we call reauthorizing No Child Left Behind. That hasn't happened. So we still have the law, but we're making a lot of accommodations to it.
Mm-hmm. Let's consider maths.
Sure.
You've said that what matters most in improving a school's effectiveness is what happens in the classroom. Mm-hmm. But I must say, when it comes to maths, I've had some intriguing conversations with friends who hated, despised maths at school, saw absolutely no relevance for it mm-hmm. in their lives or to their future. And they've transferred that bias, that belief, if you like, onto their children who are now saying the same thing. And I wonder to what extent you think that intergenerational bias is where we need to start.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I also think that that needs to be coupled with improving teacher preparation in mathematics. We have a lot of primary school teachers who do not get adequate preparation to teach mathematics well. I mean, it's a very, very precise language of how to model the things we see in the natural world, and it's thousands of years old, and yet we don't prepare teachers to do that well. So that's a problem. I think we also have knowledge that children enter school with a lot more capacity to do mathematics and to think quantitatively early that we don't take advantage of. And if you begin to sort of stack those things together, we're just really creating obstacles to children doing better in mathematics rather than facilitating their doing better in mathematics.
It's that idea that children enter the world and grow into their mm-hmm. skin with an inherent sense, numerical sense.
Yeah.
And somehow we put a kibosh on it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And some of it's because we have an image of what school mathematics should look like, and it involves very early numerals and kind of formalized ways of thinking about mathematics rather than encouraging children to use what they know about number to, I don't want to get too romantic here because that can happen, but I think the idea is we want children to build skills but at the same time see the range of places that you can use those. And typically school mathematics is textbook and pencil and paper driven, and it doesn't allow them to see how mathematics can be used creatively.
So. But you can shout to the cows come home. Mm. Why are you convinced that mathematical reasoning as a way of thinking is valuable in our lives? What would you say to those parents and their children who have wiped it off the agenda?
Yeah, well, I think the unfortunate thing is that it has lost favor. And unfortunately, it's been one of the most important things throughout history. Sort of solving society's problems is using mathematics in a way that we can depend on. I'll give you a great example. I'm reading the book called Longitude. Mm-hmm. You might be familiar with mm-hmm. it. Trade book that's been quite popular, but back in the 1700s, every important figure in the Royal Society was a mathematician. So when they encountered serious problems that they needed to overcome, they turned to mathematicians to help solve those problems. And I think we've become societies of users and consumers rather than thinking about creating. And the one area which I try to impress upon my own children, but also others, is that engineering is an area that I think as a society we need to be increasingly dependent on, and we see fewer and fewer people going into that field, which does a couple of things. Parents should know that there are jobs in engineering and that the salaries are good in engineering and that there's a need to help children see that as a kind of a vocational track for them. But to get there, they have to know mathematics and they have to be very comfortable.
But still, David Shard, you'll have people go and kids say, I don't want to be an engineer. So why is maths relevant to me? I'm going to drop out at year nine.
Yeah, well, then mathematics is relevant for being an entrepreneur, working in business. I don't know. It is difficult to conceive of any position that isn't dependent at some level on mathematics. And I think oftentimes parents don't realize that mathematics isn't just about quantitative, you know, sort of the traditional mathematics we think of, but it's about reasoning and being able to make decisions for ourselves about our retirement accounts, about our own finances. It is much more pervasive than we want to give it credit.
One of the great challenges, you don't need to convince me, but you have convinced me. But what one of the great challenges, and it starts early, doesn't it, is that you're dealing with, you're asking students to move from the concrete to the conceptual to the altogether abstract.
Right.
To what extent is that a challenge right from kindergarten for teachers?
I think the biggest challenge is that teachers are fearful of their own understanding of it, and so they will often get trapped in the concrete because it's understandable for them, and then they struggle to help children get to abstract. In fact, we know that many what we would call pre-algebraic skills can be taught to children as early as 5 and 6 years old.
So, for example?
Well, finding unknowns, so you could take a simple number sentence that's represented by objects. So 3 apples plus how many apples will give me 5 apples. And that how many is the early pre-algebraic idea of there being an unknown. Mm. And so you can teach that to very young children and that they can become very facile with that kind of idea. And then as we, algebra, which is in the U.S., algebra has become sort of a important benchmark for graduation. And so, but we treat it as though it's an entirely different subject, when in fact it's really just an extension of arithmetic. And so if we continue to sort of build those abstractions as children grow up, we facilitate their achieving that kind of level of reasoning much earlier.
Still very hard, though, isn't it? It's hard to excite children about the abstract when so much else of what they're learning is very concrete.
Mm-hmm. It is, and this is where I think you have to be very clever at showing them how games, sort of iPad-type games and those kinds of things rely on our understanding of algebra and other kinds of mathematical tools, so that if we don't have that, they don't get to do the kinds of things they want to do. And one thing we've found children are very excited about is when they get to build their own robots or build their own apps for their iPads, but they have to understand basic mathematics to do that. And so there are ways to motivate. But again, when you look at our public school systems, they tend to be under-equipped to do those kinds of things with children.
But for you, a big focus needs to be on teachers.
Absolutely.
And their own biases and lack of confidence.
Absolutely. And, I mentioned that quote you mentioned earlier about if it's going to happen, it's got to happen inside the classroom. That relationship between children and teachers is essential. And we know that one year of inadequate support and teaching can kind of set children back for multiple years. And so each of those years is critical, and particularly in a subject like mathematics, it's very hierarchical. Our understanding of whole number sense really feeds our understanding of rational number sense, and then the abstractions that we begin to see as we apply it to other areas. So teachers' knowledge, teachers' confidence in teaching, their interest in building their own understanding of mathematics is essential, which is what I'm talking about here while I'm in Australia.
What's the single most exciting reform in mathematics education in America right now?
Good question. I think there's been a tremendous amount of effort being focused on in early childhood, because we know we've learned so much about early number sense predicts school achievement, success, better than any other variable, better than literacy, better than parent income. If children can develop early number sense, then their ability to sort of reason across subjects is very, very powerful. So that's one of the reforms we're trying to get individual states to spend more money on preschool education, particularly in the area of numeracy.
David Shah, thank you so much for joining us while you're in Australia.
It's been such a pleasure, Natasha. Thank you.
Dr. David Shah is chair of the National Board of Education Sciences in the US, a Barack Obama appointment, and he's also dean of the Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education at the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And loved your thoughts about what he has offered us today. Get on the website abc.net.au/rn. Look for Life Matters. You can comment there, you can email us, or you can tweet us at RN Life Matters. Look, coming up, does paying a premium for fair trade products like coffee, your morning coffee, does it really make a difference? That's coming your way.
Was Christian Europe a casualty of the Great War? And what impact did the conflict have on belief?
And should the Allies have occupied Germany at the end of the Great War? And possibly prevented World War II?
World War I, memory, perceptions and 10 critical questions. This weekend, an exceptional range of programs. Historians, writers, thinkers, poetry, diaries and songs. Join us Saturday from midday.
Yes, indeed. Looking forward to that extravaganza to commemorate the centenary of World War I this weekend. 10 hours, 10 contentious questions and some of your favourite RN presenters. And in fact, on Life Matters today, we are also heading back to the Great War and into that intimate terrain of the diaries that were left behind. That's coming up shortly. But first up, everyday economics. Do you ever notice that green and blue circular fair trade logo on products in the supermarket? Coffee is often where you'll see it. Then what? Do you consider buying the product because it will enrich someone's life? That's the assumption anyway. Or do you skip over it on the assumption that it's overpriced? Or is the decision more complicated still? Why do some coffee shops charge quite a bit more for fair trade beans, and yet some don't charge much more at all? And what's the meaning of fair trade anyway? All that is under consideration for our Everyday Economics segment with economics editor of The Age, Peter Martin. Good morning.
G'day, Natasha.
What are we buying when we buy fair trade?
We're not buying just a higher price for farmers and producers. We're buying a guaranteed minimum price. This turned out to be very important around 1990, it was around 2000 actually. What happened was Vietnam, which was nowhere in coffee production in 1990, flooded the market. Mm. It went from nowhere to being the second biggest coffee producer. The coffee bean prices fell to less than the price of production. And that's really where the coffee fair trade movement started. And it was to give producers a guaranteed minimum price. Now, that's less useful now because, as we know, coffee prices are very high, but they still seem to think it's worthwhile because there's a lot of paperwork and so on to go through to get fair trade certification, and they do it. So producers, there must be something in it for producers.
That's right, even despite the fact that they could probably gain an equivalent price on the market if their coffee wasn't fair trade.
Well, this actually takes us to the quality question. In reading studies of this, and I've put links to several of them, or given you to put links to several of them.
Yeah, they're very interesting. So, fair trade and quality is an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, because fair trade products, particularly coffee, is often of lower quality. Now, why should this be? It's sort of standard. Standard incentives, or as your previous guest would have said, standard maths. If you've got a contract to provide beans for a minimum price, that's your fair trade contract, and then the free market offers you more for premium beans, you'll sell the good ones on the free market, right? And the less good beans, that's sort of the offcuts, if you like, will go on fair trade. Now, that is said to happen. It happened particularly in 2010 when coffee prices spiked, and indeed lots of fair traders, these are mainly families who, coffee's actually, it's the second biggest traded commodity in the world, but it's a family product. That is, it's made in small farms throughout the world. So lots of them just abandoned the contracts and went on the free markets.
Gee, so they abandoned the fair trade contracts that they were obliged to meet.
I think there's an insurance aspect to it. So they wanted to keep that relationship going for bad times. I know a fruit producer in Orange who does this. They don't get a good price for exporting, but they continue to export as a sort of hedge, as insurance against what Woolworths or Coles, their only big customers, might do to them. So there's that sort of aspect to it.
Mm. So when we walk into a cafeteria and we buy a coffee, can we be sure that the money that we're paying goes to those who most need it?
There's little doubt about that. That's just what I was talking about with all of the paperwork. Now, does it do them any good? I got this idea and mentioned this to you to talk about it from reading The Economist, which is always a dangerous thing to do.
I don't know about that, but anyway, come on.
In this instance, it is, I think. The Economist magazine has run a sort of campaign against fair trade, and it's reported on study after study that says, oh, they don't really help people. When you go, follow the links and read the actual studies, you'll find they're not anything like as definitive. And I think economists have a term called revealed preference. Mm. Revealed preference is, look, don't look at what people say, just look at what they do. And you'll find that farmers are very keen to sign up for fair trade, even though there's a lot of paperwork involved. So I think it must benefit them, notwithstanding the repeated articles I've read that got me interested in this.
You've also been wondering why fair trade products are more expensive. And I guess, you'd assume it's obvious. But as we've been discussing, as coffee fluctuates, the price of coffee or cost of coffee and price of coffee fluctuates in the market, then you do have to wonder, why is fair trade more expensive? Is it more expensive to produce?
It shouldn't be. This is the frightening point, really. Now, it is more expensive. So if you buy, a bag of coffee beans, it might be a dollar or so more for fair trade. The best estimate is that it probably costs them 20 cents more for a 500-gram bag in fair trade. Now, that price difference, and the price difference for a cup of coffee, by the way, should be about, the British study I've read said, 1 penny. Mm. That price difference can double the income of a family farm. I mean, it's very significant, but the actual price to us is very little, because the cost of a cup of coffee, there are 7 grams of beans, a lot of water, a lot of labour, a lot of electricity, a lot of rent goes into that, but not much coffee. So we are charged, where there is a premium, we're charged far more than that. Why does it happen?
So the actual retailer is leveraging off our good sense.
And this is why. It's you've heard of the term price discrimination. Mm. If you haven't, you should have, because you see it everywhere. So
explain it for us, because this is everyday economics.
Yes, well, in everyday economics, you'll get a cheaper product if you're a student. It costs you less to go into the cinema, right? You'll get a cheaper or more expensive air ticket, depending on all sorts of arbitrary criteria. One of them is whether you go economy or not. You get, if you go out for a meal, you'll get it cheaper if you say you're a local. The price discrimination happens everywhere, and the reason is that if you're selling something, you've got this dilemma. If you push up the price, yeah, you might earn more, but you'll lose customers. If you bring down the price to get the customers, well, you won't get the profits. So what you need to do is to split the customers into two groups, those who are price sensitive and those who aren't. Now, this is wonderful. This is like, the British economist Tim Harford wrote, getting turkeys to vote for Christmas. With fair trade, the people who are prepared to pay 10 cents more for a cup of coffee identify themselves.
Yeah.
and everyone else gets the cheap product. That's why they do it. It's not, and there's less of this happening now, which is another phenomenon, but it's not that fair trade costs that much more. Bananas in Europe are fair traded, and that's one of the products that actually does cost more, because a banana is a banana. There's not much processing that goes on. Mm. But in the case of coffee, in the case of coffee beans, even in the case of cotton, which is made into a lot of things after it's grown, it really shouldn't add that much more to the price.
Mm. Although that's shifting, and I think Tim Harford actually challenged one particular local cafe, didn't he? Which had quite significant consequences, because he wrote it all up.
Yeah, and then
they were charging 10 pence more, not 1 pence more. And suddenly they thought, God, our reputation's at stake here. We're actually charging too much for fair trade coffee.
And this is the movement that we are having. We're having Coles in Australia. This isn't fair trade. This is fair treatment of hens. All of their eggs are now cage free, right? They've rather than charge a premium, they're using fair trade, if you like, to enhance the entire brand. Hague's chocolates now, you know, it's in small print. You can see it in the labels on their windows. They now don't sell chocolates made with slave labour, because that happens in cocoa production. Nestle and Cadbury haven't yet got on board. But they don't charge more for chocolates like that and less for other chocolates because, and this is what's increasingly happening, that would be seen as offensive. It will be seen as bad to, I'll get a cheaper Hague's chocolate, but some child might have been enslaved.
Yeah.
And so
I mean, that's a positive thing, isn't it? Because it points to the normalisation of the sort of expectations that were corralled into fair trade products.
Yes. Now, fair trade as such is tiny. 7 billion, you know, the figures we talk about in the budget. Well, that's 7 billion worldwide in 2001 were fair trade products. That's, and, you know, it's had a big effect on those families, you know, coffee farmers. But it's tiny in itself. We've seen an evolution. In fact, it goes right back to the slave trade when slavery-free cotton was sold in the 18th century. But
By the Quakers.
Yeah, that's right.
So, by the Quaker abolitionists. That's such an interesting story.
The evolution we've had now is that in the 70s it started out with direct trade. That's what it was called. So you had a direct relationship with the farmers. Well, that obviously can't continue as something gets bigger. It's become indirect. Then there was a price premium. That's now vanishing. And what we're getting is it really actually doing perhaps what the inventors of the concept might have always wanted, which is it becoming a norm. And we're seeing that now with clothing, where Target says it doesn't buy clothing made in sweatshops and things like that. So by all means, buy it. You shouldn't pay much more for it, really. But if you do pay much more for it, you're the kind of person who does, and you obviously don't mind, and that's probably all right.
And that's exactly what the retailers expect of you.
They're going to find out whether you're prepared to pay more or not somewhere or another, so it's not a bad way to find it.
Something tells me that we're going to actually hear from people in the free trade sector in response to our discussion today, and I encourage that, so do get on the website and talk back to us and talk to Peter too. Peter, thank you very much for joining us this week for Everyday Economics. Thanks for all your work and the great links that you provided. There's lots of good reading on this one on our website. Thanks, Peter. Peter, our everyday economist, I should say. He is the economics editor with The Age. Love to hear from you, as I say, on this one. And our listener feedback line, just a reminder, 02 833 1430. And I'll pop a post up on our Facebook page as well about this, so you can comment there if you'd like to. Well, here on Life Matters, here on RN, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. We're going to go rifling through some historical diaries next. Really beautiful stuff. Thank you.
Brian Lucas is the man in the firing line. Barry O'Farrell told him to quit his top Catholic job because of how he handled the sex abuse crisis. An official commission attacked his decision not to report offenders to the police. But Brian Lucas is hanging in there, torn between the community's demand to report sex offenders and the victims' pleas that he say nothing. His revealing exclusive interview on the Religion and Ethics Report this afternoon at 5:30.
Well, RN, as I mentioned earlier, has a whopping big broadcast planned for you this weekend. 100 years ago this year, young soldiers and others headed off to the trenches or the battle lines of World War One. This was the world that was meant to end all the war that was meant to end all wars, of course. But the world was a very different place afterwards. And for our centenary broadcast this Saturday and Sunday, 10 contentious questions over 10 hours, a stellar lineup of guests and themes, and some of your favourite RN presenters. The schedule is on the RN homepage. Our most intimate understanding of World War One often comes from those personal diaries that were left behind or brought home afterwards, with entries perhaps scribbled hastily in pencil by the light of a flickering lamp, full of stories of adventure and heartache and fear and courage and thoughts of home. Here's one soldier, Archie Barwick, writing in his diary about the landing at Gallipoli on the 25th of April.
They must have made cocksure of breaking right through, for they told us there would be no haggling in the villages we were to pass through. As all the prices would be fixed, we were paid on the 22nd with notes which had Turkish writing on them. The fleet set, picked up their anchors and slowly steamed out of the harbour. What a mass of ships there was as we slowly steamed out of Lemnos. We could hear some of the warships belting away at the forts as we went along. That night everyone was as happy as they could possibly be. We had mandolins, guitars and banjos going for all they were worth. Nobody thought of what was going to happen on the morrow. About 5 or 5.30 we heard a crackle of rifle fire and we knew then that the 3rd Brigade had landed. We then got the order to fill the boats and down we filed onto a destroyer. The Ribble was her name. She had a few wounded and dead men on her. They were the first we had ever seen. It needed nerve, I can tell you, for now it was daylight and the water was just a mass of bursting shrapnel. It did seem funny to hear the bullets cutting into the scrub alongside of us as we went along, but no one seemed afraid, and we were laughing and joking as we went along. I don't want you to think I'm skiting when you read this, for I will take my oath on it that it is true. I know myself I never felt the slightest fear for the first day or two. It was when we began to realise that bullets hurt when they hit you that we knew what fear was. The first time that fear came to me was on the 3rd day, when we were in a perfect hell of bullets, and men were being killed all around me that I felt frightened. And I am not ashamed to say that I had a terrible fight with myself that day. One part of me wanted to run away and leave the rest of my mates to face it, and the other part said no, we would stop and see it out at any cost rather than show the white feather. And this sort of thing went on for about an hour, and a bayonet charge settled the argument for me. I was fairly right after that.
An extract from Australian soldier Archie Barwick's personal diary, read there by Toby Schmitz. Now, the State Library of New South Wales is digging into its extraordinary World War One collections, and next week they launch their first exhibition for the centenary of World War One. It's called Life Interrupted: Personal Diaries from World War One. And one of our guests has just handed me one of these diaries, the actual original diary, and I got incredibly teary as I opened its pages. Maggie Patton, it's all your fault.
I'm sorry.
Maggie is head of original materials at the State Library of New South Wales. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also we have a very committed volunteer, Judy Gimbert, one of the volunteers who's been transcribing this collection of war diaries, page by page. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you.
This is a very moving document. Just touching this document is extraordinary.
And when you look at the front, you can see there's always details of the next of kin. And that particular one has a dedication from his wife. As she's handing him the diary to record his days, which is quite beautiful as well.
Dated the 9th of the 11th of 1915.
That's right. So this is the diary of Arthur Moore, and he was a stretcher bearer. He enlisted in 1915. He went through quite a saga during the war, eventually coming home in April 1919.
So he survived.
He survived. He was wounded at one point. He was given a medal for bravery, but he did come home alive.
And just to describe this is a very small little black book. And yes, there is an inscription by his wife, but minute writing in a sort of purple pencil, it looks like, cursive, very precise. Wednesday the 15th, very cold last night. And then this is the challenge.
Yes,
the transcription. We will get to that. How have diaries like this come to be in your collection?
In towards the end of the war, the librarian at the time, William Ifold, actually had a whole collecting project where they advertised in newspapers for people to bring and deposit in the library their diaries and letters.
This
recording
is back
at the end of the war.
Gee.
And so it was, the idea was that he really recognised how important those personal memories and those records of that period would be important, and it actually says in the documents how important it would be for the future generations and future students and researchers. So even then they were recognising that now we would be interested in the reactions of the general person at war.
Mm.
So we collected around 200 or so collections of diaries and letters up until about 1922, but the library has continued to acquire letters through donations and purchases since then. So now we have a collection of over 1,200 from various servicemen and women.
And perhaps it takes years, perhaps it takes another generation before a family can cope with revealing the intimacy of that experience.
So that Archie Barwick one that we listened to a moment ago, he deposited his diaries into the library and no one in his family knew, and it wasn't until many years later that he came and saw them for the first time and he brought his daughter in to look at it. And it was an incredibly emotional experience for him to see the records of his time at war and for her to see his reactions at seeing these diaries. And yes, often, particularly just after the war, they weren't things that people wanted to remember. People threw them out. I know certainly my grandmother got rid of my grandfather's medals because it wasn't something, it wasn't until later generations appreciate what it means.
Yes, indeed. And I'll read you Amy's comment on our Facebook page.
Mm.
My grandfather was in Changi. He wrote a diary as a letter to my grandmother. Sadly, when he returned and gave it to her, she didn't want to read it.
Mm.
She was so relieved to have him back and wanted to move on with life. I think this may be a reflection of the attitude of the times. Don't ask them about what they'd been through. We didn't know about it until just before his death at age 80 when he gave it to his daughters. Very precious.
That's right. And and what's fascinating too is when we were collecting them early, just after the war, we were very particular about what we collected. And so these people came back with these amazing stories. And sometimes our staff at the library would say, no, I'm sorry, you haven't written enough. We don't want your diary. It was an amazing process.
Oh.
Now, of course, anything that survived, we're really interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get to some of those amazing stories. Judy Gimmett, this has become something of an obsession. Actually, it's really inspired me about the prospects of volunteering in one's life.
Yes.
So how did you, why did you want to get involved with this project of page by page transcribing these diaries?
I'd been a volunteer for a few years with the library, and they said they wanted any of the volunteers who could to transcribe the diaries. And I'd been a typist all my working life, and I thought, don't really want to do that. And then I thought, this is something I can do.
Mm.
And so I've enjoyed doing it. It's been inspiring, really, to read some of the stories.
Why has it been inspiring? Perhaps take us inside some of the scenes and stories. And these aren't soldiers' diaries alone, are they? There's a whole range of diaries.
That's right. That's right. At the moment, I'm doing a diary of a nurse, Florence Elizabeth Holloway from Wagga, and she's 42 or 43 when she enlisted, and she's in Cairo when she's writing the diary. And it's quite different from reading the soldiers' diaries because she's not amongst all that's happening with the war, but she's seeing the result from the soldiers in the convalescent home.
Mm.
But I've done stretcher bearers and a journalist who used to sometimes write in shorthand, and I do shorthand.
There's a trick.
But it's not always easy to read somebody else's shorthand, but I tried as best I could.
Are they honest? Are they honest accounts?
I hope so.
Do you think they're written with an audience in mind, or were they very much their outpouring of
these incredible scenes. I'm thinking of these often young people, and not so much in the case of the nurse, but who wouldn't have ever imagined ending up in Egypt or Belgium or France.
No, not at all. There was one that I did, Frank Maloney, who when he came back from the war, studied to be an architect. And he used to write to England for books and poetry, and terrible writer, an awful time trying to transcribe his. But he would make comments about the books he wrote, and then he'd go off being a stretcher bearer and talk about terrible injuries to the soldiers. And I wondered if this was a release for him to write about something else other than what he was experiencing in the war. And there was one really sad, part where he receives a telegram, and he said, on Monday morning after parade, a cable of five deadening words, father had died on June the 15th. And so he goes on, he said, I can't realise, but I know it. The cable words repeat mechanically in my mind, and for the instant I see home for a second. Then the deadly blackness comes again. Mother, Betty and Jeff and 14,000 miles separate us. If I only knew their position, that Jeff will finish his school and go for his scholarship and Betty finish her schooling. Isn't it lovely that he sort of thinks about what's happening at home, and it probably he does it constantly too.
Maggie, have there been tears opening up these documents?
There always is.
I mean,
tears.
I couldn't even, I just opened it up and hadn't even read the words and I was already in tears.
I know, you often get tears, and it's often in those situations that Judy's talking about where they're referring to people at home, where they've received a letter from home or a parcel from home, and that's when you really get that impact because they're so far away.
Now, there's humour too.
Yes, there's fantastic humour.
Release, and another kind of release.
And I think that's what it is, really. It is, it's trying to step back from that daily hardship that they're going through. Yes, so they'll talk about the beautiful French women. They'll talk about the food. There's, as you know, we know there's always lots of conversations about sport and about cricket and playing football, but there is an awful lot of humour. So, for example, I have an example here from, I'm just going to try and flick my pages here.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's an example from...
makes it more real. It's radio.
From Eric Ward.
We're dealing with material history here, folks.
It's Eric Harford Ward. He was a tailor's cutter from Bathurst. And on the 9th of August 1915, he says... so they're in the trenches. Sandy emptied the trench can of urine and cut up the cheese soon after. Water cannot be wasted on one's hands. We all ate the cheese and raised no objections. I made some burgoo out of wholemeal biscuits. Jolly fine. In my section, there's a reinforcement who has pronounced habit of fingering his nasal organ and chewing the ends of his fingers. It's very descriptive. They very often talk about strange things that are happening.
Extremely descriptive. What sort of commitment has this meant for you, Judy, and the challenges as well?
I think when I retired, I realised that I needed something to occupy my time. And this is very rewarding, I think, doing this. I go once a week and spend the day there. Sometimes if I can, I go a second day. But there's a lot of commitment there, and you can't always get a spare computer if you go on the day that's not allotted
to
you.
It's one of the hottest volunteering jobs,
absolutely.
I gather.
And it's lovely because they all talk to each other and you can hear them asking each other about different words and places and really communicating about what they're reading.
But then the challenge is bringing this awareness to the next generation, the subsequent generations, about what... what can we learn from those stories about war and its impact?
I think it is, and I think that's partly what we're talking about in the exhibition that's opening next week, Life Interrupted. I think it opens on the 5th of July, because we're trying to talk about the personal reactions to war, the way people felt, what the impact was when they came home, how it interrupted their life, their careers, their families, but also how it interrupted the following generations of relatives who were unwell, who had mental problems, who couldn't cope. So it's all of that impact on war is an incredibly important thing that we're trying to bring out.
Certainly felt it in my family, two generations
That's
on.
Right.
It's still very potent, the impact of war. So now, but there's an online component to this.
Yes.
And this is where listeners, if they've got diaries, what can they do?
Well, there's a few things we're doing. Mm. We've digitised all of our collections, so we have. We'll be gradually completing them towards the end of the year, but we currently have over 1,000 volumes digitised and online. Judy and the volunteers have transcribed over 680 volumes, over 67,000 pages. So we're putting all of that up so people can read the diaries. We're also putting all the lists of the servicemen and women online so people can recognise if we have some of their relatives' collections. But we also have an opportunity for people to add photographs if they have relatives that are involved. Later on in the year, we're going to be launching a transcription tool, an online transcription tool, so that other people can get a chance to try and transcribe some of these diaries, because it's a wonderful experience. Mm. At the moment, we also have launched a huge collection of portraits from Crown Studio, which were done around 1918, and they're online on our website and on our Facebook page, so people can recognise relatives as part of that, make comments. So we're trying to work with the community on it.
Yeah, fantastic. And so just to be really tangible, people can go to the website,
yes.
They can look at these incredible diaries, which you've been transcribing,
yes.
Judy. They can upload photos if one of their relatives happens to be there.
That's right, yes. They can add notes. They can tell us what happened to them. We'd love to know what happened to them,
yes,
after the war.
Yes.
Mm. Judy was quite interested in that aspect too.
Yes. I mean, you can sometimes find... The internet's a wonderful tool to find out some information. And, I found that Frank Maloney did become an architect and won a prize for something, but that's as far as I got with any information about him.
Yes, so we're looking for other details about our servicemen and women as well.
Terrific. Are there diaries in the collection that there is no family known about them?
Absolutely. That's part of the process that we've been going through, trying to find out descendants. So that's partly why we are trying to put the names out there, so that we can contact people. But, you know, many people came back, they didn't marry, they didn't have children, their families have died.
Mm. Mm. Look, terrific to have you both in, to give us just a taste, a flavour of, well, this online exhibition, but also a material exhibition in the real world.
That's right.
Saturday the 5th of July, running right through until the 21st of September.
That's right.
Life, yeah. Interrupted Personal Diaries from World War One. Judy Gimbert, thank you very much.
Thank you,
for
it's a pleasure.
Inspiring me with volunteering possibilities. And Maggie Patton, Head of Original Materials at the State Library of New South Wales.
Thank you.
Natasha. And we'll link to all of this from the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/rn. And of course, you must tune in this weekend for our fantastic big celebration, commemoration, I should say, of the World War One centenary. On Life Matters, I think just enough time to squeeze in some of your calls from the week. Last Friday, we did a great talk back on self-made rituals, DIY ceremonies, and here are some of your responses.
Yeah, g'day. Hi, my name's Steve from Wollongong. When my son turned 13, myself, my father, and my son, my brother and my brother-in-law organised a rite of passage hike for my son to enjoy. We picked the nearest mountain and we climbed up to the top and met together for a celebratory breakfast. And it was a very special experience, very moving experience, and a really nice way to mark his transition from boyhood into young adulthood. And I'd encourage any fathers with sons to organise a similar sort of passage, just to mark a very special occasion. It's something that we don't do enough in our modern society. And I really enjoy the program. Bye.
Good morning. It's Gail. I'm from Canberra. My father died when I was 9 and I was absolutely devastated. It held me back for quite a long time. Anyway, I was in my 50s and my sister actually got cancer and it really threw me and I just sort of wasn't coping. So I went and saw a counsellor. It turned out my unresolved grief about my dad, my fear of losing my sister. So we created a ceremony and we got some friends together and we went down to where we used to live in Canberra, an old suburb called Westlake, and people played a part of our neighbours. One lady played the part of our neighbour who used to talk to my dad over the back fence about vegetables. Another lady used to know that he loved dancing, and so she started talking as if she was talking about my father called Cecil, and she was saying, oh, Cecil and I used to love dancing. And so we had about 5 or 6 people who all gave a little story as my dad's friends. It helped me to move on, and it was a wonderful experience. And I do thank my sister Eve very, very much. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. What a great call. A listener feedback line for all your thoughts and stories in response to anything you're hearing on Life Matters, 02833 1430. But don't leave the network, because Books and Arts Writing is Books and Arts Daily, beg your pardon, is coming up on Life Radio National. Get with it.
Focus.
Hey, you've got Missy. She's a great character in Rake.
Yes, she's going to be coming along. And we're also going to have Emma Ayres, who woke me up this morning. She's the host of Breakfast on Classic FM. It's like waking up in fairyland. All this lovely music floats into your bedroom and there's Emma's soothing voice talking to you. Turns out Emma is a wonderful viola player, so she's going to play the viola. And she also rides a bike.
And she's also going to fill in behind me for a week coming up in July, as it turns out.
That's coming up very shortly.
Fantastic, Michael. Have a great show and stay with RN, won't you? Coming up straight after the news. Approaching 10 a.m. now. Thanks for your company today. Looking forward to it tomorrow. Cheers.